Thank you very much, Dr. Davis, for those great remarks. I am given the responsibility without my notes of introducing two people who are going to be on the panel. So since my notes disappeared or covered up and I can't see them, I'm going to wing it. I'm going to start with Michael Hamburger. Michael Hamburger is a friend of mine. Several years ago, Michael and I joined up in a project here at the church to figure out what it meant for Christians and scientists to find common ground when it came to issues of what I like to call creation care, or often environmental stewardship. Michael and I put together three workshops. It ended in McCormick's Creek State Park, and Michael, as a geologist, was able to give us insight into the multiple layers of rocks and all kinds of things. That was fascinating. And yes, Michael's a friend of mine. Michael is not a Christian, which is one of the reasons he's on this panel. And he worried about that, and we talked, and I convinced him that it was important for him to be here, if nothing else, because he's my friend, and I wanted him to be here. So thank you, Michael, for being here. Michael takes his PhD from Cornell University, and whenever we have weather like this, I'm glad I don't live in Ithaca. It's probably snowing there. John Beggs is a professor. Both are professors at IU, and John Beggs is a physicist at IU. He also has been a part of multiple Trinity Fellowship events and some of the Veritas forums we've done in the past. So John and I and Dan have worked together very well for a long time, and we really appreciate him being a part of this. John takes his PhD from Yale University, which in terms of weather is really not that much better because I lived there for 7 years. I've been asked to be the moderator of this discussion, and that is because I have no scientific credentials. So they needed me to do something. They decided to make me the moderator. What I actually am here for is to cut off people who have long-winded questions and to try to make sure we get out of here on time. So I'm just the referee. I've got no knowledge. I want these guys to come up. We're going to begin with Michael and John asking questions or making comments about Ted's, about Ted's lecture. And then we'll go from there and allow you to ask questions of all of them.
Okay. With or without this. So I think first
I want to compliment you on a beautiful
for all of us to think about and chew on. I am going to bring some naive questions here. I first have to say that Pastor Bob brought me here under false pretenses. He said he was having an event with an eminent theologian, and I thought he said geologian. And so you've got a geologist here, and to make matters a little worse, you've got a Jewish geologist here. And one even worse than that, who isn't really trained at all in Jewish theology. So I'm the guy who's going to ask some kind of naive questions and maybe throw some curveballs or whatever. So first, I just want to compliment you on especially some of those closing thoughts were very powerful about the ability of a scientist to both exalt in the power and beauty of nature, which is something that I think draws many scientists to the field, and also, I thought that was somebody up there telling me to quiet down. Okay. And also a sense of humility about the world, and I think that's something very powerful about my field, in particular in geology, where we are sensing our place in a gigantic planet and over gigantic periods of time place us in a more a small piece of a much, much larger puzzle. I guess I wanted to start with a simple question and that occurred immediately on seeing the title of this talk. So it's focused on the connection between Christianity and science. So why focus just on Christianity and not on history of faith more generally. I think my own religion, Judaism, clearly has a very strong connection with science. Islam also, especially early in its history, had very strong, powerful movements associated with early science, and of course other religions as well. So can you expand a little bit on the focus on Christianity in particular, and perhaps the exclusion of other faiths?
Well, obviously, in the context of this particular event that I was involved with, that's how the thing was defined. And so I stuck with that topic. But your instincts are completely on target, I would say, that much of what I said would have appealed to a person, a devout Jew or a devout Muslim, much of what I said, and should, because, of course, those are the major monotheistic faiths. Now, I don't really know a lot about Judaism and science, although I know more about that than I do about Islam and science, just to be frank. I would not be able to say with much confidence similar ideas about Islam and science, even though I wouldn't be surprised if they exist in that tradition. Judaism and science I'm a little more comfortable with, and of course a lot of this is the common biblical roots that I spoke about, and that verse from Jewish scripture that is quoted by so many believing Jews and believing Christians in the history of science. So I'm with you on that completely, that I could have done that. Now, could I have done it as effectively? Perhaps not, because I don't know very much about those traditions, with the exception of a few things in the history of Judaism and science. So, but yes, but as for faiths outside of monotheism, I doubt it. The reason I doubt it is because I don't see they have anything like a doctrine of creation, which was the focus of this paper. So I would say there I'd be very hesitant to say that a devout Hindu or Buddhist, a theistic Buddhist, and many of you Buddhists are not theistic, or some other faith from outside of the cradle of the Mediterranean, if you will, the Jewish, Christian, and Muslim faiths, would be able to say similar things. I doubt that. I could be persuaded by evidence that I'm wrong.
So let me turn maybe to a little more challenging or even controversial aspect, and it relates to the kinds of things I study. I think you used the phrase maybe irrational things in nature. So it's hard to imagine anything more irrational than a giant earthquake or a volcanic eruption or things that transform lives. And there was a critical moment in European history. You probably know something about it. The great earthquake and tsunami that engulfed Lisbon in 1755 on All Saints' Day, a gigantic religious holiday, a complete destruction of the city, fires burning everywhere. People ran out of the collapsing churches and went down to the pier for safety, and then a tsunami swallowed them up. And as you can imagine, this is an event that happened in a major European capital, kind of at the peak of the Enlightenment, so a great kind of collision of ideas, I think, about the natural world, and also a period at the very beginning of many of the natural sciences that are, kind of the beginning of modern sciences. So it did somehow play out in a conflict between religious thinking about natural disasters and the beginnings of scientific thinking. And it happens that we did a class a couple weeks ago on the Lisbon earthquake with a scholar of history who brought to my attention a sermon by a prominent Jesuit priest by the name of Gabriel Malagrida, who, let me just read a part of his quote, who said, "Learn, O Lisbon, that the destroyers of our houses, palaces, churches, and convents, the cause of the death of so many people and the flames that devoured such vast treasures are your abominable sins and not comets, stars, vapors, and exhalations and similar natural phenomena." So this, at the time, these were the kind of developing theories to explain these phenomena like earthquakes and volcanic eruptions. "Tragic Lisbon is now a mound of ruins. Would that it were less difficult to think of some method of restoring the place, but it has been abandoned and the refugees from the city live in despair.
As for the dead, what a great harvest of sinful souls such disasters send to hell. It is scandalous to pretend that the earthquake was just a natural event. And he goes on from there. So this, of course, might be at one extreme end member of the response to natural disasters. And since that time, I've learned the term theodicy, which you probably are well aware of, but I wasn't. And the challenge of explaining these terrible, unfortunate natural events in a theological view. So maybe some general comments about how these catastrophic events fit into these kind of challenging dialogues between science and religion.
Oh, well, I think you've put your finger on the single strongest objection to belief in God that a person can make, at least in my time, our time. The existence of suffering and what some theologians call natural evil, because it doesn't involve a moral evil that there's an earthquake, whereas it does involve a moral evil if I stab you in the back, and things of that sort. I do not think there's a satisfactory philosophical or intellectual answer to the problem of evil myself. But I'll say two things more about it. First, I think the problem of evil is also a problem for people who don't believe in God. Because then does the category evil have any real meaning? And if it doesn't, there's no such thing as good or evil in an ultimate sense, then you cannot coherently claim that the Holocaust was evil. And you cannot coherently claim anything else is evil. And that's a problem too. So I think that the problem of evil is a problem for believers and for unbelievers for different reasons. Whereas for the believer, the design in the universe is just like a no-brainer. It's like, well, of course. All this makes sense perfectly. Of course we would expect it to be this way because God is like this and the world is, you know, God's a creator, he's a mathematician, et cetera. All this makes sense. For the unbeliever, often it doesn't. Just a brute fact that cries out for a deeper explanation is not going to be forthcoming. So I don't see it necessarily as, you know, two sides of the same thing. I don't. I think there's a stronger argument on the theistic side for a universe that does make sense, as I tried to argue for tonight. But the problem of evil, I think, is a problem for everyone. As a Christian myself, I have a more existential response to the problem of evil. Many in the room might be familiar with the book by C.S. Lewis called The Problem of Pain. There's the epigram at the front of that book is from George MacDonald. That won't surprise very many. If you have your copy at home, go home and look at it again. And here's what it says. The Son of God suffered unto death, not that men might not suffer, but that their suffering might be like his. That's what Lewis did. I say that's not an intellectual response. It doesn't resolve the apparent contradiction between a good and powerful creator and the existence of suffering and evil. But it puts it in a different light. And so I think within Christian circles, I would suggest that only a believer who believes in the incarnation can make a response like that, if you think about that. Only to say that God himself, in one of his persons, suffered unto death in this particular way, so that God has become one of us and entered into our suffering, not just in some abstract manner, but in a direct manner, in which he bore that suffering himself. Now, in your field, of course, geology, correct me if I'm wrong about any of this, the earth itself in its current form is shaped by natural forces that do kill organisms, and not just microorganisms, but kill large organisms that we all have an interest in and many of us admire, organisms like deer and bears and sea creatures, right? If your picture of Earth history that you give us from geology is correct, this has been going on all along, long before humans were ever here. And so that in Christian circles in the 19th century, they began to call this the problem of death before the fall, okay? By which they meant animal death before the fall. That term is still in use, but it originates around 1840 when people first begin to realize this picture of nature and first begin to think theologically about it, no single solution emerges on the theological side as to how to understand that. But to accept that as a brute fact is important, I believe. So I believe on that issue, science means does have a message for Christians. We need a new theodicy. The old traditional theodicy taught by Luther, by Calvin, and John Wesley on the Protestant side, not taught, however, by Augustine and Aquinas on the Catholic side earlier. They denied this theodicy. The theodicy that Luther, Calvin, and Wesley all taught was that natural evil was a result of human sin. And so if you accept an ancient creation with all of these forces shaping the earth and killing all those organisms, that dog don't hunt. And so you need a new theodicy. So that's an area, in my view, where a proper Christian response to science is to look for a new theodicy. And there are many such that could go on for a long time tonight that I don't have time to go into, and we would, that's all we would talk about. We've probably got more to talk about.
So good. Do I have time for one?
Yes, go ahead. Question? Go ahead.
It's
yeah.
Not a quick question.
It's another curveball.
I don't know if it's a curveball, but there's a graph that I've spent a lot of time looking at. I'm going to describe it to you, and you can I'm sure, imagine it fairly easily. It is it's based on a public opinion survey by the Pew Research Center, kind of that does periodic reviews of attitudes about religion and society. And this is a graphic that somehow tried to quantify. On the x-axis is support for evolution. You can pass this down and take a look at it on the way. Mm-hmm. On the y-axis is support for environmental protections, just generally. And as you can imagine, there are some, and it's classified by religious affiliation, and so there are some groups that are down in the lower left that have very little support for evolutionary science, and those also seem to have very little support for, you know, environmental protections. At the upper right end are groups that are strongly or more strongly supportive of evolutionary science teaching, presumably, and also supportive of environmental stewardship, generally. And there's this big spectrum. There are a few oddballs that are a little bit out on the side that we could probably learn something about. So somehow this relates to the evolution of Christianity over time. So if you look at the denominations there at various places along this mm-hmm. spectrum. Mm-hmm. So I just love to hear you comment on kind of how the history over the last centuries has kind of evolved apparently into quite a broad difference in the kinds of attitudes about science more generally and its relation to environment.
Can we share that with others?
And how many hours did you say we had? Yeah, to talk about this?
And these are just Michael's questions.
Yeah. Well, how this all came about is not something I can easily summarize, although it is something where I could if I had enough time.
You can spend a lot of time looking at that plot and trying to identify perhaps where your affiliated group lies. So you might find, for example, the mainline Protestant sects up here, the Catholic Church down here, evangelical churches here, depends on whether they're predominantly black or white majority churches. And they're, even if you look at a single group, you'll see a broad spectrum depending on which type of Baptist or which type of Jewish group or whatever. And it's fascinating to stew on a little bit. But clearly there has been some kind of a historical segregation of attitudes about science, and it certainly is far from uniform and somehow relates to historical and cultural trends.
Well, for me, the most interesting data point on that chart is the presence of conservative Jews in the upper right-hand corner. General acceptance of evolution, strong doctrine of environmental stewardship. I think they got it right.
The Orthodox Jews, by the way, are quite a
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I imagine that they are. Would this be modern Orthodoxy?
We'll have to go back to the original data.
Because there's so many different threads there, too. Yeah,
right.
Because Rabbi Schneerson would take a very different view than some other Orthodox rabbis.
Okay.
Of course, the Talmudic tradition is all about that.
Yes.
Understanding the Hebrew scripture by rabbis and how they argue with one another vociferously about the meaning of a given piece of text, a portion of a piece of text, even, or a portion of a word, right? And how they will do that.
And somehow that relates, I think, to an affinity towards scientific investigation, where truths are to be kind of determined through discussion and rational examination.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I would say on the part of just speaking now as a scholar of Christianity and science, I'll offer an opinion. I hope no one leaves the room as a result of this, but I think that a very, very large number of clergy today, Christian clergy, Protestant clergy and Catholic clergy, but especially maybe more conservative Protestant clergy, don't know the first thing about science and don't know the second thing about the doctrine of creation. I think that's the case. And completely misinterpret Genesis. In my view, in its context, remember, the Bible was written for us, but not to us. And so it was written to Hebrews in centuries before Christ, that Genesis was written, and almost certainly, from the way I've seen it, written, put in its current form in a context of the Babylonian captivity, which is why the days in Genesis begin with the evening and the morning, because that's the Babylonian time reckoning pattern. It was not the Egyptian time reckoning pattern, which was morning to evening. So if this were an unadulterated Mosaic text, it wouldn't have said evening and morning. It would have said morning and evening. So this text is put into that form at that time. And at that point in history, the Jews were held captive in a land that was exceedingly polytheistic, that worshiped the stars. And that's why it says at the end of the fourth day of creation, and yeah, kind of by the way, he made the stars also. They were divine beings that the Babylonians worshipped and believed controlled our destinies. This is where astrology originates. The Hebrews are going down in this text through all of these gods worshipped by ancient peoples and knocking them out one by one and saying that the true God made that thing the true God made. That's what it is. It's a theological text debunking polytheism and pantheism in its context. It's saying nothing at all about a blow-by-blow description in a modern sense. The form of the text is based on other ancient Near Eastern texts. Many of the ideas are based on other ancient Near Eastern texts. The Hebrew text is not the only one that teaches humans are made in the image of a god or gods. It's not. It's not the only one that says that humans are first made out of lowly materials. It's not. It's not the only one that has a pattern of days of creation. But it is the only one in which, as a rabbi translates it, God gods the world. This rabbi is a great historian of Hebrew thought, and his name is Norbert Samuelson. He used to teach at Arizona State for many years. And Norbert's translation of Genesis says, instead of saying, God in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth, to emphasize the uniqueness of this Hebrew verb bara, which is something that only God does in the Hebrew Bible. One of only two verbs like that. Only God can bara something. That God gods the heavens and the earth, and then they exist. So it's teaching the Hebrews that the source of all of this is the Creator, is your God. That's the source of all this. And that all these other gods are false. That's what the text is about. And so people who draw all these other inferences from the text, in my view, are just barking up the wrong tree and barking very loudly. But that's one person's opinion.
Not just one in this room, at least two.
So is this on?
Okay.
Yep. So, wow, I mean, you're a pretty good pitcher. That was a curveball, a knuckleball, and I don't know what else.
Change of pace?
I think you at least hit a lot of these guys. So I don't, being the loyal opposition here, let me just say, I loved your talk. I would love to like sit down with you for hours and just draw more of your thoughts out. The intelligibility of the universe is of particular interest to me because I do biophysics, and one of the things we look at are brain cells and how groups of brain cells can encode information and can basically statistically model the world we're in. But if our brains had to basically map every possible contingency and do it well, they'd have to be the size of a football stadium, right? And yet we get away with this little tiny thing that's relatively small. And the reason we get away with a relatively tiny brain is because the world is very predictable. It is intelligible. It's the thing that you were seeing in so many quotes that you put up there that were very, very powerful. And I think that once you see a few examples of things, then you go, oh, wait, now I can infer some general law. And I have no right to think that the apple falling in my backyard should also govern the motions of Saturn. And yet it does. And we pull that off again and again and again. And that, to me, is very stirring and speaks that something's going on that doesn't have to be that way. I guess maybe a question or we could interact on this. Have you ever heard of Stephen Wolfram and his like cellular automata explorations, anything like that? If you haven't, it's kind of an
obscure area. I recognize the name. That's as far as it goes.
Okay, so one of the things he did is he looked at these very simple little sets of rules that you could play out on something called a cellular automaton. And in this set of rules, there were only 256 possible combinations of rules. And the bottom line is that most of the rules that you pick lead to very boring outcomes. So if you set some initial conditions, you know, all the cells turn off or all the cells just turn on and off and on and off and nothing interesting happens. Now, there's one set of rules that leads to very interesting things, you know, little particles collide and then they produce offspring and so forth. And so the band for complexity is very, very narrow. Mm-hmm. And now if you go to a higher dimension and you look at the same set of rules, you again find, you know, perhaps hundreds of millions of rules in an extremely narrow region where you get interesting complexity. And this area where there's interesting complexity also allows you to make predictions about what will happen in the future. And so one of the things that I'm interested in in my work is, like, where could you actually evolve a brain that would get you anything, right? So in these simple examples, you're not going to get anything because you can't predict anything. And over here, if it's just turning on and off, you don't really gain any information. But here, in this very narrow slice of rules, you get this regularity. You have a compact way of expressing what's going to happen. The system is intelligible. And if you train an artificial neural network, it can actually pick up what's going on and profit by predicting the future. And so the stuff that I'm looking at totally maps onto what you're saying. And so I'm just going, yeah, 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 yeah. And I'm thinking, this totally makes sense. And now here, I'm hearing you on the other side. And what I'm getting from you, I think, is something that I experience very often just in academia in general, which, let me be blunt, but, you know, we can talk frankly, is that being religious makes you stupid in some sense, right? It makes you not open to experiment. It makes you not open to going back and forth with the evidence. It makes you dogmatic, and it makes you kind of like stuck in a rut. And that plot that you sent around is kind of hinting at that. It's basically saying, look, if you become more religious, you're not going to be concerned about the environment, and you're going to think that evolution is just, you know, it goes against the scripture, so I just got to shut my mind down. And I will admit that there's certainly trends like that. Things are going in that direction. I don't think it has to be that way, though. I know plenty of scientists who are very open-minded, who are, you know, willing to see the intelligibility of the universe and who are open to different ways of looking at scripture. You know, for example, St. Augustine in, you know, what, 400 AD said, you know, we don't have to necessarily take a literal interpretation of Genesis. And there's a modern-day apologist, John Lennox. One of the things that he says is, you know, the early church creeds, they had all kinds of things. Like, you got to believe in a virgin birth. You got to believe in Jesus Christ. You got to believe in his resurrection, you know, dot, 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 dot. But in there, they never really had, you got to believe in a literal Genesis. A lot of people thought, you know, it's allegorical or it's figurative. And people throughout Christianity have had a wide spectrum of beliefs on that. I don't think this, in some sense, the stereotypical version of, once you see evolution and you're a Christian, you just run and head for cover. Or you think it's Satan in the flesh and you got to, you know, put a stake through its heart or something like that. I don't think that's an accurate view of the scientists that I know who are believers. But I don't think it necessarily has to be the fate of Christianity. I think we might be in a bit of a rut politically or something's going on. But it doesn't have to be that way. And I don't think that the Christian position necessarily leads to that.
So I don't know. I'm trying to straddle both of you guys.
Can I just clarify before, lest anybody come away with the wrong impression?
Yeah, absolutely.
I do not think it's a characteristic of Christianity or people of faith to deny or attack science as a way of knowing about the world. In fact, I think science is one way of knowing about the world, and there are many other important ways of knowing about the world, of which religion and theology and art and music and philosophy are among them. Even that chart is meant to show even among Christian faiths, there is a giant spectrum from those who are totally engaged with, of course, this is a simplistic way, scientific thinking about the world, and there are those who are less. And so somehow that's the intersection of the theological Christianity and the real historical, political, social Christianity. So, but please.
I'm curious. Michael, in your field of geology, do you, you probably know a number of geologists who are Christians.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah, many, right?
Yes.
Of those, can you think of any of them who don't believe that the Earth is billions of years old?
No, not in my direct. There is a community of people who are trying to seek alternate explanations to, you know, come to terms with dissonance in their reading of Scripture. But that's a very small community.
Yeah. So. Well, I'm connected with organizations of Christians in the sciences. And I have a number of friends in a group called the Affiliation of Christian Geologists. Maybe you've heard of them.
I know that group.
Someone like John Suppey, for example, is a member of that.
Yeah.
They have told me when I've asked them to estimate from their interactions with others what percentage of people that they know of as Christians in geology don't believe the Earth is billions of years old. And they say it's low single digits.
Yeah.
So, like maybe 2-3% of geologically trained people who are Christian who don't believe the 4.5 billion year old history of the Earth. Yeah. The church at large doesn't understand this. I think they do not get this. And they think that the geologists who believe the Earth is 4.5 billion years old, who actually don't contest that evidence, have somehow caved in to peer pressure. That's a common perception in many conservative churches today. That would not have been the perception, by the way, when the word fundamentalist was first used.
Yeah. Yeah.
The word fundamentalist was first used in the United States in July of 1920 in a Baptist magazine by a Baptist minister named Curtis Laws. And he used it to describe himself and other like-minded individuals who wanted to fight against creeping modernism, as they called it, in the churches. None of the fundamentalist leaders, zero, believed the universe was a few thousand years old. In fact, the leading fundamentalist of the day, you could argue, was a man named William Bell Riley in Twin Cities. He founded an organization called the World Christian Fundamentals Association in the year 1919, the year before the word fundamentalist is first used. And he said in a debate he had with apparently a member of an atheist organization in the late 20s in Arkansas, he said, when the guy claimed, "You Christians all think the Earth is 6,000 years old," Riley responds by saying, "I do not know one single intelligent fundamentalist who believes that, and the Bible never said any such thing." That's what Riley said. Now, my point isn't whether Riley was right or wrong by what he said. Nobody else was in a better position to gauge the pulse of fundamentalism than Riley. And that's what he said. And so it is simply a fact historically that in the 1920s, when the so-called fundamentalist modernist controversy raged, no fundamentalist leaders believed the Earth is 6,000 years old. Now, the people who did hold that view were not in the fundamentalist mainstream. They were especially members of the Seventh-day Adventist churches. That's where it was taught as doctrine, based on the views of Ellen White, a major Adventist prophet in the mid and late 19th century. She specifically taught that God had given her a vision of the creation in which she saw that each of the days was a literal day. It had happened exactly that way. And you can see why that would be crucial for Seventh-day Adventist theology, worshiping on the seventh day, okay? But this is all true. Now, this is hotly contested by Ken Ham, who doesn't know the history of his own movement well enough to talk about it. I can show him chapter and verse of where Henry Morris and John Whitcomb say they got those ideas from the Adventists. Okay? I can show you that. I can show him that if he would be willing to listen. But that's the case. So just as a point. So it's only since the 70s and 80s that these views have become common among evangelical churches. In the 50s and 60s, practically all of the Bible schools, like Moody and Biola and Philadelphia College of the Bible and the others, taught the gap theory, which is an ancient universe and then six literal days of creation a few thousand years ago. It's a view that by then scientifically had no viability, but in the 1840s was taught by the leading textbook in American geology, which was Edward Hitchcock. Okay, he taught that view in that book. So it had scientific credibility in the 1840s. It didn't in the 1940s, but it was being taught in the 1940s at all the Bible schools, but it was not a young earth view. So that's one thing that a lot of people don't know, but those are simple historical facts. They're not really contestable.
Yeah. So then my question is, how then did we get from that spot to this spot where, I guess in popular discussions, particularly those that are tinged with the political, aim, it seems that Christianity is anti-science. How do we get to that spot? Because I don't think it's that way at all. I mean, I know all kinds of people who are, you know, Bill Phillips won a Nobel Prize. He's religious. You know, there's tons of people. So Francis Collins, who's stepping down from having led the NIH for a long time, founded BioLogos and is trying to blend these things together, he's no idiot. I mean, I just don't understand where this notion comes from that, and I know you're not necessarily espousing it, but I do think it's out there. And it is being propagated. How do we get to that spot where it seems that you can kind of take a pot shot at someone if they're religious by just saying, look, you don't believe in science. You're anti-science. What happened historically to get us to that place?
Well, there has always been a gap in the United States, at least, between the scientific knowledge of the so-called elite, the scientists themselves, and the scientific knowledge of the general public. That gap has been there regardless of a religious factor. That has just been there since the beginnings of American science. And it's perhaps larger today than it was in the 19th century when science wasn't as abstract as it is today in many fields. That's before relativity theory. It's before evolutionary theory, which, of course, is not obvious on the face of it. People don't see dogs evolving into something else. But it's gotten more abstract over the years. The gap is even worse than it used to be, as far as I can tell. So it's incumbent upon some people to try to cross that gap. And usually it's scientists who will speak to the public or who will teach science or write textbooks. And for doing those kinds of activities, traditionally, they don't get tenure. Is that right?
So do it after tenure.
And so you can see what kind of importance the scientific community ultimately places on that, okay? So look in the mirror and start asking, why is this the case, right? And maybe in your latter years, choose a different trajectory for your career. I'm being serious here, right?
I asked my wife what I've been thinking about lately. And since I got tenure, of course.
But if you do have some eminent Christian scientists, and you've named some, who have tried to cross that gap, and sometimes they get a reception, and sometimes they're met with great resistance from conservative Christians, usually, who are very upset with something about their message, right? Very upset with it, with the case. But again, you know, the person who has the most influence, I think, on conservative Christian views of science is Ken Ham, who is on American views, right? He's an Australian by birth, but he's been in the country for decades. And, of course, he operates the Creation Museum and the ARC thing and has this something like 500 radio outlets for his program. This is an enormously influential person who's not a scientist. He was a science teacher once in high school level. He's not a scientist. And the problem I have with Ken is not that he believes what he believes. I think I encourage all of my own students to believe what makes the most sense to them after they try to inform themselves of something. I don't have a problem with Ken Ham believing that's the way to go. The problem I have with him is that he thinks it's his way or the highway. Right. And he even will say that Augustine was a compromiser. Augustine was a Augustine, whose theological knowledge and Christian commitment, in my view, shouldn't be questioned at all, was a compromiser because he didn't believe in a literal creation day, which is true. He didn't. He thought the creation days were metaphorical, and that God had created all of the universe at once in an instant, and that it had unfolded in time. He was influenced by Philo of Alexandria, a great Jewish philosopher from the first century, who influenced a lot of the early Christian thinkers on how they approached Genesis. So there was not a unanimous view at all at that time. There were two main schools of thought, the so-called literal school, that the days were literal and ordinary days, or the more metaphorical school, that the days represented the passage of time, and that God had accommodated his knowledge to the ignorance of human beings in telling us the story of creation, which was so profound and mysterious we could never understand it if he just told it straight out. That they were the two schools of thought prior to the Reformation. The Reformation makes things much more literal, frankly. Calvin dismisses Augustine's view. He basically says it's not correct that these were metaphorical. These were literal days. Calvin says God created in the space of 6 days. He created the heavens and the earth. He's really arguing against Augustine from 1,000 years earlier at this point. So that becomes the dominant Protestant view for a while. But in the 19th century, most Protestant leaders in America, at least, adopt an ancient earth. They accept the science, and they begin to wrestle with that in various ways.
And a little humorous side note, perhaps some of you saw the news story about the Creation Museum suing the insurance company for not providing flood insurance after they had damage to the ark. And they couldn't get the insurance company to pay for it. I don't know where that fits in.
Anyway. Do you have one more question, John?
No, let's go to the audience.
We can go to the audience. Yeah. I mean, I think it's pretty clear based on the conversation, especially with Ted, that the problem, the conflict between science and religion is not science, it's religion. We've created our own problem in the Christian church by misunderstanding the text and spinning these theories that match up with Henry Morse and other people like that. So that's true. It's on us. It really is on us. So what kind of questions do you have for these gentlemen? Go right ahead, Bill.
So, if you mean by plasma, what I understand to be a plasma is it's so hot that you don't have electrons basically. And if it's very, very hot, you won't even have nuclei that are all bundled together. You'll have things flying around. You'll have proton here and a neutron there and electron. So then my understanding of elements in that state is not what I'm hearing from you. Like you'd have a whole table, a periodic table of elements, and if you heated it up to the plasma state, there would be all kinds of stuff happening. I don't know that that's going to be like that you even have elements. I don't really know. I mean, so where did you read this? What was the place where you got it?
I don't know. I've seen this several places.
Yeah. So my question is, the definition of being a plasma is that you have independent particles flying around. You don't have nuclei in the same sense. I could be wrong on that, but that's my understanding of it. So I would say your question isn't well framed.
Well, I guess what you're saying is that we don't know what we
have. Well, if the other thing I would say is if the Earth is that hot, if it's plasma, then gravity has to pull it all together.
What's the sun?
Well, the sun is filled with hydrogen and helium and other gases like that. And so what you've got is gravity pulling it together, but the individual elements are holding together. Their nuclei are compact, and you have the electrons captured in the orbits. And then these guys fuse. Two hydrogens fuse to form a helium. It has less mass, and then you give off E equals mc squared, and that is pushing it out. Gravity's pushing it in. So if you're talking about a plasma, you're talking about something that's hotter than the sun. And then that's not even the Earth, right? It's not even a gas. It's something else. It's beyond. So that's why I don't know that the question is properly framed.
Well, what we do know is that approximately 300,000 years after the initial Big Bang explosion, the universe cooled to the point where atoms formed, okay? And those atoms, out of every 100 atoms that form, see if these numbers, I think these numbers are close enough, but 75 of them are hydrogen atoms, 24 of them are helium atoms, and one is a trace of either lithium or beryllium, and that's it. So in the early universe, before there is a solar system, you have hydrogen and helium, and that's it. And that's how we know that the solar system is not, the sun is not a first-generation star, because the sun has inside of itself many heavier elements than just helium and hydrogen. And the solar system is full of heavy elements, meaning anything heavier than helium. And so the sun, with its time span, it makes sense in the story. It's coherent. If the sun is about the same age as the Earth, about 4.5 to 5 billion years old, and the universe is about 14 billion years old, then the sun is about a third of the age of the universe. And so it could indeed be a second or third generation star. We know it's not a first generation star, as I said, because it's got heavy elements, and there weren't any heavy elements in the very first generation of stars. Those first generation of stars produced the heavy elements that you and I are made of, like nitrogen and carbon and oxygen and all the rest. They're produced in the interiors of stars through nuclear fusion. And so the earliest stars make the other stuff. That's why Carl Sagan famously said, we're star stuff. He meant that literally in terms of our physical components. All the stuff we're made of came from stars, except the hydrogen and helium, which comes out of the initial Big Bang.
Maybe I'll just add a comment and maybe come back to your initial proposition. And that is that it is a well-posed question in the sense that our assumptions about constant radiometric decay are not necessarily 100% correct. And it is worth investigating the way that changes in physical characteristics of the universe or our planet might affect our clock that we use to measure time. And to some degree, gets us to reflect on the immutability of some of these laws of nature. And one of the kind of brave things that scientists have to do sometimes is to reflect on whether Newton's laws are 100% laws or whether that's only laws within a certain frame of existence and that we might have to extend them to more broadly defined rules. Can you comment on that?
Yeah, well, these speculations that you've referred to about plasmas and radioactivity don't make sense to me either, but I'm not, you know, I don't read physics literature very much. And most of it I wouldn't understand because I never went far enough in physics. But I've never seen a paper or heard of a paper that shows any variation in radioactive rates under any conditions of more than approximately 0.5%. And out of 0.5%, you're not going to be able to convert 4.5 billion years into 6,000. It's just not going to happen. And so if you read the creationists' own views on the radioactive date thing, most recent views are published in a project called RATE, capital letters RATE, published maybe 10 years ago. And there's a so-called technical monograph of nearly 800 pages that I have studied, and there's a short version for bookstores to sell. Here's what they say. First of all, they admit that the Earth is full of decay products, of radioactive processes, all over the place. That so many of the elements that we find in the Earth and the isotopes are the result of radioactive decay from what are called mother nuclei to daughter nuclei, that's happened over the years. So how do they match that with a young universe? Well, they speculate, and this is all you can say, they speculate that it could have happened to two points in the biblical story. Before life was here on the planet, which would be basically the second day of creation, before there's the creation even of vegetable life, so that if radioactive decay greatly accelerated at that point, the heat produced by that process wouldn't have fried any living things. And the other time, they say, is during the flood, when the putative layer of a mile thick water around the Earth would have shielded at least the non-sea life from a lot of the effects of that radiation. That's the scenario that they have to create. But they admit that the Earth is full of these decay products. For me, the most powerful evidence of the ancient age of the Earth and the universe is the decay products we have today in the universe. In the universe today, of all the nuclei that exist, the only nuclei that are radioactive that still exist without being constantly created by processes have enormously long half-lives. They do. And so they've been around for a huge amount of time. Whereas the young half-life materials, every one of them, is created on an ongoing basis by a radioactive decay process that's still here. To me, that's a huge amount of evidence that the Earth and the universe are really old. That's huge. I just don't see any other way to interpret that consistently with the science.
Let's get in at least one more question from the audience, if not more. So who else has a question? Some people would pay a lot of money to hear this kind of thing. We get it for free. Go right ahead. Yeah.
That, right? So it's just that it's only a problem for the theist because you're not being consistent, right? And so an atheist could stand outside and go, you know, I don't have that problem. But I think implicit in the whole problem of evil is this idea that this is evil, right? I mean, do you think that what happened in Lisbon was evil?
That's not a word I use. Excuse me. Sorry. Wake everybody up back there. I think that for me, that's a word that is associated with a kind of moral compass that I associate with religious thinking and other types of moral thinking. So the stuff that I study, the impacts of natural events, can actually be partly understood as products of both the physical processes, the biological, the social, the economic processes that led to the places and the ways people were living in Lisbon in 1755. And interestingly, the guy who kind of took on the battle with the Jesuits, the Marquis de Pombal, who kind of took over Lisbon in the aftermath of the earthquake, famously said, bury the dead, feed the living, maybe as a shorthand for a kind of practical yet moral response to the suffering of the people around, and kind of led to a kind of modern, perhaps secular, although he wasn't a secular leader, but a secular thinking about natural disasters that kind of separates the evil of the disaster, if you call it that, to the humanitarian response that you can do after.
Yeah, well, in the context in which I mentioned, made the point that I felt that evil created a problem for the non-believer as well, was in the context of moral evil. So in other words, for example, I don't believe if a person does not have a sense of absolute right and wrong, then in my view, it becomes problematic at best to make a claim that the Holocaust was evil, something like that, or slavery was evil. Okay? I don't think there's a coherent basis to say that. And so, now maybe I'm mistaken, but my instincts suggest that that's the case. Yeah, natural evil being a different category. That's right, a different category.
Right, but if I could just comment on this thing. I think that the natural evil, here's what I'm guessing, if I could throw you a curveball. So yeah. So the thing is that in your organization, which I'm a member of and I like, and I think we're working toward doing good things. We're working towards stopping, you know, the Earth from overheating and from the oceans from rising and things like that. And we tend to think as humans that we're working toward good. And so even though you might not want to label the earthquake in Lisbon as evil, you are working against climate change. And you got to be, Michael, doing what you think is right, don't you?
Oh, absolutely. I guess maybe I'm having a little trouble with your separation of natural evil from, intentional evil or somehow human-created evil.
Right.
So maybe
right.
It's a choice of the terms. Certainly, there is a very powerful place for all of us to engage with the world around us in ways that make life better. And I meant to mention one other aspect about natural disasters. Is this is a place in particular where Christian faiths and Christian communities have played an enormous role in the aftermath of disasters around the world. In this country, it was really Hurricane Katrina that kind of laid bare some of the systemic evil, you might say, in our society that left so many people so bereft. And it was really religious groups, much more than the government in a way, that came to the fore to advance those humanitarian goals in the aftermath. So, it's hard to get one's head around the massive destruction that can be associated with natural disasters, but I think it can be universal to have compassion and reduce suffering for the people who are affected.
But is that good?
Yes, I have. Whether it's defined in a religious framework or not, there certainly is, and I think should be, a moral compass that defines how we respond to challenges in the world around us. And I think that's one of the great powers of religion and Christianity in particular.
Well, let me take things in a different direction about this, the natural evil problem, which is the term that I've used, but I'm not sure is the right term. Addressing the audience, how many of you, my wife and I just got back from Gatlinburg and from Great Smoky National Park. We had never seen it before. Now that I'm retired, we had a chance to see it in the fall, right? It's very beautiful. If you feel the same way, if you feel that something like that, or the Rocky Mountains, or the Canadian Rockies, something like that, you know, they're stunningly beautiful in my opinion. I don't know whether you share that opinion. Many of you might. If you feel that this is evidence of the wonders of creation, then think about this. What produced those things was the same geological forces that cause earthquakes and volcanoes, which kill thousands of individual organisms and often people, okay, and tidal waves. So exactly the same natural forces that produce these. So, and likewise, the sequoia tree is an example in biology. My understanding is that the sequoia can only reproduce in forest fires. Is that right? That the heat, for to open the cone and pop the seeds out requires the kind of heat you get in a forest fire. And so, and then that tree has an advantage reproductively over the other vegetation in the forest, which burns up, and these seeds pop out and germinate, and so you get more sequoia, right? So if you think the sequoia tree is beautiful and we ought to try to preserve them, think about where it comes from. So in other words, it's a morally ambiguous thing to call this natural evil, as I glibly did, because many of the things we regard as beautiful actually result from these things. Many strict creationists believe that about mountains, that they're a result of the flood, ultimately, and divine judgment on the earth. So should you glory in the beauties of the mountains if they're the result of human sin? I'm seriously raising the question because it's a real issue that you should have in your mind if you are inclined to reject this ancient story of the earth. The beauty that we have, so much of the beauty, valleys and mountains and so many other features, how many features could you name? Dozens, right? Of the earth that many people regard as profoundly beautiful are the result of these long geological forces that kill organisms.
I think that's, you've articulated why I shy away from that term natural evil. Yeah. It is part of this grand and magnificent process that shapes our world and shapes our universe, and it's part of the duality or the complexity of our world that we need to come to terms with and appreciate in all of its complexity.
Let's get in one more question, can we? Yes.
Yes, that's for me, I guess. Yeah, sure. I think it's a great question.
Get your mic up, John.
Oh, yeah. I think it's a great question. So one of the things that you spoke about already was just that when you approach science, you need to have humility. You must necessarily be willing to lay down your hypothesis, however dear it was, if the experiments don't confirm it. And so you got to be willing to say I'm wrong, and you got to be open to whatever nature tells you. So that's where being a Christian, trying to model myself as much as I can in my character after Jesus, who is incredibly humble,
who came down, you know, and let people spit on him and so forth. That's humility. So maybe I ought to be able to say, okay, you're right. When you review my paper and you point out this thing that's wrong, I admit it. Okay, I'm wrong. I got to change this. I got to go back and do the experiment again. So there's the humility part, but then there's also the other part that you touched on, which is just the confidence that there is order in the universe. And so one of the projects I'm working on that we talked about briefly here, I want to work on that, and I have a strong hunch, a faith, a belief that this project will turn out to be correct, that there are only a very narrow set of possible combinations of rules or laws of physics that would even allow evolution to occur. I'm pretty confident of that. And I think that, you know, I believe that God set it up a certain way. Now, I could be wrong, right? So Kepler was wrong about, you know, the Platonic solids being giving us the diameters of the orbits. But I think that idea that there is an order there to be found, it's like a puzzle. It's like I know that there's going to be an answer, and so it propels me to search in certain directions. Now, you might say that's biased, but as long as I retain the humility and let the experiment tell me whether I was right or wrong, I think it's okay.
You know what? Well, if there's no more answers, maybe we can do one more question. Is that good? Yeah. Or maybe everybody wants to go home at this point. Thank you very much, panel. It was a delight.